made a choice not to use any archival material, so any footage of the actual family in the film. And so instead, we kind of one step removed, and we're kind of analyzing more the community that lived around the tragedy's responses to it than the actual case itself. So I was very aware that I did not want to exploit this girl anymore. So she's in there and she makes appearances, obviously, but it's that idea that you kind of, she comes back just when you've forgotten what it's all about, and then you're reminded, oh gosh, yeah, it's this little girl. So that was sort of her purpose. She's sort of this spirit that floats above the story in some ways, and it becomes more about the nuclear family, about mothers and daughters and fathers and sons, and kind of these relationships that we can all relate to. I think that's why we're so obsessed with this case, is we can all kind of connect to it in some way.
The filmmaker Kitty Green guiding us through her documentary Casting JonBenet, which, despite sounding like yet another tabloid retread of one of America's most notorious unsolved crimes, it's actually all about us. More of that interview coming up today on The Cinema Show. Plus, do you prefer your films set inside the Parisian studio of a famous artist or amongst a women's separatist movement in underground Berlin?
What actually happens is that we don't really see that duration played out in time on screen. We just understand it due to the exposition in the narrative.
More on that soon. And coming up a bit later, documentaries are proving to be the ones to watch in Berlin this year. We'll speak to the directors of a film that gives us an insight into another side of America.
It's a world where teenagers speak openly about the fact that they most likely get shot before they turn 20.
That's all to come on this special edition of The Cinema Show at the Berlin Film Festival on Monocle 24.
Now at 7:41, with a case that transfixed the country for nearly 20 years, the murder of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey. Well, for the first time ever, her brother Burke is speaking out publicly about this
case. On Christmas night, 1996, the body of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey was found in the basement of her family home in Boulder, Colorado. The strange circumstances surrounding the murder ignited a media firestorm, which, 20 years on, looks set to continue. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Late last year, American television schedules were clogged with all manner of specials, marking 20 years on from the still unsolved murder of JonBenet Ramsey. CBS aired a 6-hour documentary series. Dateline interviewed the 911 operator who took the original call from JonBenet's mother, Patsy. Lifetime even aired its own dramatization of the case. Spoiler alert, it wasn't very good. Filmmaker Kitty Green has taken an entirely different approach, and wisely so. Her documentary, Casting JonBenet, cleverly switches the focus onto some of the inquisitive folk who have followed the case via the long and frenzied media coverage, as they audition to play members of the Ramsey family. Tara Judah spoke to Kitty Green at the Berlin Film Festival.
JonBenet Ramsey, the name conjures memories of a little girl's life cut hideously short. Her parents and her brother, the chief suspects in a murder case that dragged on for years.
We held open casting calls across Boulder, Colorado, which is the town where JonBenet Ramsey was born and died. We invited the community, like actors, just regular people, to come in and just talk about, in addition to play a role in the film, but also talk about their own kind of connection to the case. It's more about kind of the legacy and mythology of JonBenet Ramsey than it is like a whodunit. So it's more about the way, the cultural obsession with this case and the way we can't let it go. So we're interested in people's personal kind of narratives. So the way that people come up with their own kind of stories in order to deal with something that essentially they can't make sense of.
It's an amazing approach because we see really personal stories from the actors and actresses. They start to talk about how it made them feel, how it affected, you know, the media coverage has affected their lives, how their personal stories are woven into it. How much did you try to elicit their personal stories, and how much did they just offer that to you?
We're very honest about how we were going to use the material, and we said, listen, this casting material will be in the film and it's all part of it. And I was shocked by how honest everyone was with us. And maybe it's an American thing. I'm Australian, so for me it was odd how honest they were, but they would just sit down and just tell me everything about their lives. And it was really an incredible process. It was cathartic for me to sit through. And we felt very kind of honored that they would share that stuff with us. I mean, in some senses, our aim was to kind of humanize this story, which has been in the tabloids forever, but it's all facts and DNA. And unfortunately, there's a girl who's lost her life at the center of all this, and that often gets forgotten. So it was lovely to kind of make it human again and reconnect it to people's own pain and suffering and grief. And that was the intention.
Let me give the motive that is ascribed to you.
Okay.
You were downstairs, maybe she came down. She said, Mommy, I wet my bed. You said, again, JonBenet, and you either pushed her or you hit her. You were exhausted, you were furious. You did it.
I like, too, that you didn't focus too much on fetishizing the JonBenet character, because it could have been about just casting her, or, you know, there could have been a lot of attention played to the kind of physicality of her. I mean, the pictures of her that have come up in the media time and time again, they're always those pageant photos. And I liked that we focused quite a lot more in your film on the stories around that, on the family, on the different characters. How did you feel about some sensitivity in the treatment of it being such a young girl?
We made a choice not to use any archival material, so any footage of the actual family in the film. And so instead, we kind of one step removed, and we're kind of analyzing more the community that lived around the tragedy's responses to it than the actual case itself. So I was very aware that I did not want to exploit this girl anymore. So she's in there and she makes appearances, obviously, but it's that idea that you kind of, she comes back just when you've forgotten what it's all about, and then you're reminded, oh gosh, yeah, it's this little girl. So that was sort of her purpose. She's sort of this spirit that floats above the story in some ways. And it becomes more about the nuclear family, about mothers and daughters and fathers and sons, and kind of these relationships that we can all relate to. I think that's why we're so obsessed with this case, is we can all kind of connect to it in some way.
When people appear in, you know, the kind of police station or the jail cell or the family home or the young boy's bedroom, these sets really give us a sense of credibility or lack of credibility for the things that the characters are saying. And the constructedness of the sets reminded me very much of Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line. It reminded me, I mean, also other recent films, Kate Plays Christine, but also your previous film, Ukraine Is Not a Brothel. This idea of the kind of constructedness that goes into documentary filmmaking.
He was just 9 when his little sister was found viciously strangled in the basement of their own home. The child beauty queen, eternally 6 years old.
The next thing I remember, my dad came and told me, JonBenet is in heaven now, and he started crying.
The whole film is about kind of the very nature of documentary, and about performance, and about truth, and about fiction, and about storytelling, and it's all kind of woven throughout the narrative, really. But we were very intentional with the sets, in that we wanted every set, you can kind of see the edges of all the sets. You can see ladders, you can see crew people, you can see, it's sort of intentionally artificial. So you always know that you're on a set, but it's not real, and it's not finished, and it's not complete. And so there was something about showing the kind of the making of this film, and a film that isn't ever going to be a film, but is almost a film, but never really, it sort of circles around itself in a lot of ways. And I think that to us was important, because there's no way we can finish it. We don't know who killed that girl. We will never know. So for us, it was about this kind of collective mythology and legacy. And sort of it ends in this kind of big montage with every theory played out. And that was really important to us, was to just have this big question mark, I guess, which sounds awful for an audience, but I think it's a cathartic experience, even though it's still, I mean, it doesn't answer your questions, but at the same time, you come out of it with a bit of a sense of relief, I hope.
What a lot of these documentaries often do is ask the viewer to play judge and juror and to decide definitively, you know, who did it or how the case should be wrapped up. And I quite liked that you play with that. And so we see really different points of view on this, including, you know, incredible empathy from some of, particularly the women playing Patsy. We see really incredible empathy coming out of them for the character they're playing. And we see them play it in different ways as well, which gives us, you know, really the understanding of different lenses and perspectives. And I just wondered as well how much kind of trust you had to build before turning the camera on to get people to really open up to you in this way, because it seems like they're pouring their hearts out.
So we were very honest and upfront about the way we wanted to put the film together, but it's very difficult because it hasn't really been a film like this before. So it's not like you can say, watch that, it's exactly like that film, because there really is nothing else like it. So, I mean, I would discuss the way I envisioned it coming together, and they and just sort of said, do you want to be part of it? And everyone kind of just was excited and just sort of, you know, jumped down the rabbit hole with us. And that was really incredible. So they were very open almost immediately, which was the most surprising thing, actually, is just how kind of heartbreaking and real and authentic these stories are.
Now we're going to get to new questions about JonBenet Ramsey's death. Nearly 20 years after the 6-year-old pageant queen was murdered, her father is speaking out in a new documentary. ABC's David Wright is here with the story. Good morning, David.
Good morning, George. Hard to believe it was 20 years...
Tara Judah speaking to Kitty Green at the Berlin Film Festival. Casting JonBenet has been picked up by Netflix and will start screening in April. Berlin is, of course, home to one of the world's great film festivals. And Tara, being the film obsessive that she is, well, she's on a mission to see them all. We asked her about three films that take us from an artist's studio in Paris to an underground female liberation army in a place called Germany.
Final Portrait is a new film written and directed by Stanley Tucci, and it's based on James Lord's memoir, A Giacometti Portrait, about the Swiss painter and sculptor Alberto Giacometti. It's set in Paris in 1964, and it's something Tucci wrote in a couple of years, but spent 10 years trying to get the money together to actually make this film and get it off the ground. It stars Geoffrey Rush as Giacometti and Armie Hammer as James Lord, who is a writer who's really interested in the artwork, the painting, the sculpture of Giacometti, and is asked to sit for him for a portrait.
Okay, let's go.
Front on, you look like a brute.
Lower your chin.
Side on, you look like a degenerate.
Not so far.
Don't smile. Don't scratch.
Oh my God.
While the film is exploring this idea that it takes an incredibly long time to craft a work of art and that maybe it doesn't come together in quite the same way as those of us who critique or digest the artwork might imagine, what actually happens is that we don't really see that duration played out in time on screen. We just understand it due to the exposition in the narrative. And so for me, what was a bit of a shame about this film is that most of the sense of movement and urgency or something happening is done in the camera works. I think Stanley Tucci is really concerned that if he does just have two men sitting, you know, in an art studio, which you can imagine sounds incredibly boring, it would be boring. So in order to liven it up, there's a lot of fast camera work that makes it seem like something hectic's going on. There's a little bit too much dialogue, it's heavy. They kind of throw in some female characters as tokenistic ways of, I think, livening up the relationship and complicating it between these two men, when actually, really, the story that he's trying to tell is just about this kind of process of art. And I think that that's a really difficult story to tell on film, so I think that's why it fails. But it really actually racks up to being quite a kind of dull and overcompensating work.
Do you like strawberries? They help you forget your problems.
What makes you think I have problems?
People who travel alone are usually in search of something, aren't they?
What makes you think that I'm alone?
So Berlin Syndrome is the new film from director Kate Shortland, whose previous films Somersault and Law audiences might remember. She's an Australian filmmaker, but also with very strong connections to Germany and to Berlin. So Law also had elements of, it was a German language film, but also elements of German life and the Second World War. And so does this film. This is about a young Australian girl played by Teresa Palmer, who is unhappy in her real estate job in Australia. She's from Brisbane. She's clearly lived a bit of a sheltered small town-ish life, you know, and so she hasn't traveled the world. She's searching for an experience. Berlin is a great place to come to do that. I mean, this is a city full of international people. It's a very welcoming and artistic city. And so she comes with the premise of photographing the kind of GDR architecture for a book she's going to put together when she goes back to Australia, but also to get some life experience. And what happens is she encounters a young man called Andy, played by Max Reimelt, who was in The Wave, and I always think of as a little bit of a poor man's Matthias Schoenaerts. But they come together and he kind of chats her up on the street. From the very offset, I would say that their interaction is strange and unnerving, and you never get the sense that it's a nice encounter or that there's going to be a great romance. I mean, I think it's interesting how films set this up.
I didn't think I'd be able to get back in, and then I realized that I couldn't even leave.
Hey, you can leave now and take a shower.
Did you lock me in?
It takes an incredibly creepy turn. So he takes her back to his apartment. The first day she thinks, oh, he forgot to leave me a key, and she couldn't quite get out. By the second day, she's realizing that she is deliberately locked into his apartment, where it's in an old rundown building. There's no street access. No one can hear you from there. No one can see you. And no one knows where she is. He's taken her SIM card. She quickly finds out that she's alone, and she's in a situation where she's entrapped and has to work out how to get out. And it's about the dynamics that play out between the two of them, as we're not really quite sure whether or not Claire is somehow still drawn to Andy, even though he's manipulating, controlling, and abusing her, and also how she's going to get out of this terrible situation.
We, the Female Liberation Army, hereby announce that we abducted the filmmaker and effector member of the gay
patriarchy,
Bruce LaBruce, and are holding him captive.
The Misandris is about this group of schoolgirls who are being formed into a radical army of lovers, and they're going to be called the Female Liberation Army. They live in Germany, which is, you know, actually set in Berlin and outside of Berlin in Brandenburg. And there's this woman called Big Mother, played by Suzanne Sascha, who I think has been in many of Bruce LaBruce's films, so he kind of wrote the role for her. His films sort of play these festival circuits, but rarely get very good international release. So they are quite hard to see outside of that sort of parameter. That said, he's extremely famous, and, you know, he's had exhibitions and, you know, lots of attention for his work all over the world for many, many years.
The Misandris in support of the... Say it, Bruce, say it!
The forthcoming...
Come on!
...lesbian intifada.
But before we shoot, we will reassign his gender.
Tara Judah's postcard from the Berlin Film Festival. This is the Cinema Show on Monocle 24. We'll have more from the festival in a moment. Elsewhere in the film world this week, Moonlight is continuing to rake in big business on the international circuit, no doubt boosted by its 8 Oscar nominations. With a budget of $1.5 million, the film has already taken $3.6 million, with some estimates putting its potential overall gross at a whopping $40 million. Moonlight opens in the United Kingdom, Korea, and Italy this weekend, and we'll be speaking to the film's director, Barry Jenkins, in the next few weeks. Meanwhile, in London, the city's mayor, Sadiq Khan, will hold a screening of the Academy Award-nominated Iranian film, The Salesman, in Trafalgar Square on Oscar night. The film is competing in the Best Foreign Language category, but its director, Asghar Farhadi, is refusing to attend the ceremony in protest over Donald Trump's travel ban. London's mayor released a statement saying that he was delighted to welcome people from across the capital and beyond to share in this celebration of London as an international hub of creativity and as a beacon of diversity. The Oscars and the screening of The Salesman will take place on February the 26th. And to get you into the Oscar mood, MUBI has a special week of films scattered with little gold men. In the United Kingdom, you can catch the Best Picture winner from 1982, Gandhi, by director Richard Attenborough, starring Ben Kingsley. There's also the 1979 family drama Kramer vs. Kramer, starring Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. And keep an eye out for Ang Lee's spectacular 2000 film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And if you're in the United States, be sure to catch the 2004 documentary A State of Mind, which follows two North Korean children training for the Pyongyang Mass Games. It's part of a North Korean triple documentary bill, which also includes Crossing the Line, about a former US Army soldier who defected to the rogue state, and Red Chapel, which chronicles a so-called cultural exchange involving two Danish comedians. MUBI is the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema. All those titles will be popping up soon, so do keep an eye out. And if you haven't tried MUBI, well, catch a whole month for free right now. Just head to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. Today's America feels like a vastly different place to the one we might have imagined just a few months ago. But despite the rapid and often largely symbolic change that can come with a new president, for some people, things aren't all that different. The documentary film For Akeem follows a 17-year-old high school student in North St. Louis, one of the most violent urban areas in the United States. This year's Berlin Film Festival had promised to reflect the so-called daily apocalypse that today's political climate has given us, and, as Antonia Mertzhauser found, they certainly delivered.
I'm here to investigate how to tear down walls. Apparently there's many experts here, and I want to bring that information back to Mexico.
And to America.
This statement was given by Mexican director and actor Diego Luna, who is part of the Berlinale jury this year. And as we all know, the festival has a very outspoken political profile. And this year in particular, there was a lot of discussion of how a film festival can and should react to the political crisis we are witnessing. One answer that was also given in the press conference was by showing a diverse range of films and perspectives. And the 67th Berlinale did that. In the competition, we had a mix of newcomers and big names. Hang Sang-soo, On the Beach at Night Along is among them, as well as Oren Movement's The Dinner and Sally Potter's Sharp Tongue Coupe, The Party.
Listen, I'm going to propose a toast to my oldest, dearest, and most loyal friend who has achieved a rare thing, which is why we're all here this evening, in case anyone forgot. Babies, excuse me, Jenny, Martha, but babies get born every day in extremely large numbers to the point of endangering the planet and all our futures. It's not every day, however, that one of us becomes a minister.
But of course, Berlinale has more to offer than the competition. You can really feel like a gold digger at this festival. There are so many films that are just waiting to be discovered, and one of them is the documentary For Akeem. Over the course of 3 years, the filmmakers Jeremy Levine and Lennon van Soest documented the life of Daje, a young black woman who lives in a marginalized neighborhood of St. Louis, Missouri. It's a world where teenagers speak openly about the fact that they most likely get shot before they turn 20. But For Akeem is not only a powerful social study, it's a very fine piece of filmmaking with an impressive protagonist. I sat down with the two directors to talk with them about the making of the documentary.
The film, at the end of the day, is really a coming-of-age story, and it's very specific to this one girl. You know, we followed 3 years in her life, and we were just completely tied to her through all of her ups and downs. You know, our approach to filmmaking in general is to really be as immersive as possible, and I think we really wanted to flesh Boonie out as a character and as a human being in the deepest possible way. And I think without such a, you know, a willing partner in that process, we couldn't have made the film that we did.
And as a filmmaker, how do you deal with this, like, serendipity, basically, effect? Yeah. Or that, I mean, you're not in control of the story at all.
But, you know, the approach is, for us, is always coming up with a plan, imagining how the film might unfold,
and then something happens in Boonie's life or in St. Louis or in the United States that changes things, and then you have to kind of go back to the drawing board a little bit and figure out how does this piece fit into her story, to her narrative. And, you know, it's just kind of this constant ebb and flow of like, okay, cool, here's our plan. Oop, actually, you know, reality has a different plan for Boonie, and so now what do we do with that new information? It's interesting, too, because you're also dealing with a real person that you care about, so when these big life events happen, you're dealing with it on an emotional level, and then at the same time you have to be figuring out what does this mean for what we're doing together here. So, you know, when we found out she was pregnant, it was devastating. And at the same time, we had to figure out what does this mean for the movie.
How did the community itself, like the neighborhood, also her boyfriend Antonio, react to your presence? And how was your experience? Like, how did you feel filming in that area? And what kind of experience was that for you?
Despite the obvious, just being these kind of white outsiders, I think, you know, the style of filmmaking in general is, you know, sort of succeeds or fails on your ability to build trust. And I think we just spent so much time, you know, on and off camera with Dajae and with her family and in her community that we got to be very well known, spent a lot of time talking about what our goals were, what it was that we were interested in talking about and exploring. And then I think really the intimacy and the closeness that the film achieves is completely a testament to the relationship that we built with her and with her family over the course of the production. Sorry, I'm stepping back a little bit, but I mean, we can all look at something like the election of Donald Trump or, you know, Michael Brown being shot in Ferguson, and we can sort of be reminded about this idea of racism. But I think really, you know, what was so eye-opening to me and what I really think the film is trying to accomplish is to really get into the psychology and just the day-to-day life of what it means, you know, from the time you're 5 years old to be told that you're a bad kid, to know that, you know, less than half of your peers will graduate from high school, to sort of have such a low set of expectations, you know, or to be assumed to be a criminal, and the way that that impacts you through your day-to-day life and just kind of what is expected of you from a broader society and who you're being told you are.
Antonia Mertzhauser speaking to the directors Jeremy S. Levine and Landon Van Soest about their new documentary For Akeem. And that's it for today's program. Next week, we'll hear from the filmmaker Xavier Dolan as his latest award-winning film, It's Only the End of the World, hits theaters.
I mean, emotionally, I'm prouder of certain things for different reasons, but as a whole and an ensemble, when I look at It's Only the End of the World, it seems to me, at least, that it's the one that's most complete.
And, of course, Oscar weekend is on the way. If you haven't managed to see all the contenders just yet, well, you'd better get a move on. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffan. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your audio. I hope you've enjoyed our Berlin special. The Cinema Show is back in London next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.